Michael, welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air, which is the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name's Fiona Donald, and I'm, amongst other things, the immediate past president of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and I'm also a recently retired consultant anaesthetist from Southmead Hospital in Bristol. So today I'm joined by Dr. James Nichols.
Hello, thank you for having me on the podcast.
Hi, James. James is a good friend and a colleague from Southmead Hospital in Bristol. So we're going to be talking a little bit about James's career in anaesthesia, but mainly about his life in the creative arts, including a bit of medical illustration, portraiture and much more, and also how James combines all these interests with his clinical work and his family life, home life, life in the village, jigsawing, all sorts of things. So, James, we've worked together for a number of years now. What I want to ask you first of all is, why anaesthesia?
So firstly, thank you, Fiona, for the opportunity to be able to come and talk today. So, yeah, I started anaesthesia quite a long time ago, 1992. And I think entry into anaesthesia was very different then. I'm going to say it. In fact, there wasn't a lot of planning went on with it. I did the usual thing. I think quite often in those days, you used to follow somebody around who was a few years ahead of you. And there was an anaesthetist called Mark Kenny, who I was at med school with, who was a few years ahead. And I remember talking to him in the canteen. And he said, have you thought of anaesthesia? It's a whole different set of knowledge, different drugs. It's, you know, and mentioned a lot of other good things about it. And I thought, and there's a job coming up at Northwick Park and I applied for it. And I've pretty well been doing it since then. I had a few breaks back doing emergency department work in Australia, but otherwise trained in anaesthetics and intensive care and consultant job as an anaesthetist. And I still sort of consider myself to be something of the anaesthesia tourist board. If we have the visits from school pupils or medical students, I'm usually still saying the positives about anaesthesia, and would very much do it again, given my time around. I love the combination of thinking about things in real time, which I think really does happen in when you're giving anaesthetics, and reacting to events. I very much like emergency anaesthesia. So I like a chaotic environment and making that calmer. I also like the fact that I've never stopped learning hand skills. So I suppose this ties in a little bit with this, is that I still am, only recently I've started doing blocks for rib fracture analgesia. In like the last 6 months, so I've gone through a process of learning how to do that and a system for allowing myself to do that. So even towards the end of my career now, which I guess I'm in the last few years of it, I love the fact that I'm still learning things. I love watching the specialty change. You know, we've gone over to much more in the way of intravenous anaesthesia, brain monitoring, much more regional anaesthesia. So it has always stimulated me. I like the nature of the work. I always consider being an anaesthetist is a bit like being a rabbit, in that you spend quite a bit of the time sitting chewing grass, and then every once in a while you have to run a lot. And I like that fluctuation in sort of calm and then intense, and calm then intense. And I prefer that to when I look at other specialties. I like that sort of nice natural flow of the day and of the cases. So hopefully not too many times have been too intense.
I empathise with a lot of what you say about anaesthetics, actually. You know, speaking, as you were saying, as the tourist board for anaesthesia, I think you're doing a good job of making it sound very attractive, which of course it is. It is the best career in medicine. So you talked about, you know, learning new skills, and you briefly talked about how that might tie into your creative life. Does that reflect an aspect of your personality and your skill set, do you think?
I don't think I'm like a purely cerebral type person. I think I like to think about things and then apply that to making something, doing something, creating something, fixing something. I don't think I would like just an environment where I sat and read texts and thought about it and had discussions about that. That doesn't feel like me at all. And I guess that works with a lot of the things that I do that are the other James activities, whether that's painting or you alluded to the fact that I also do a fairly odd version of jigsaw puzzle solving. So But again, all those things where you sort of think about things, analyze things in the real moment, solve problems as you go along. Painting is a lot like that. I mean, I also like cooking. It's similar with people who like cooking. And I guess that almost goes back to school. I mean, my favorite subject at school was chemistry, and that is again thinking about something, but then doing a practical experiment and going through the sort of, the aim, the equipment, the method. Results and conclusion. There's many ways you can apply that rigor of that subject that I loved at school through to many of the things that I've done, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I think, a lot of anaesthetists would say that anaesthesia, whilst obviously has a major scientific background, there's a lot of art involved in it as well. Looking back through various things that you've written, that are available online, I noticed that you credit your mother with sort of bringing the creative side to your life. When did you kind of first pick up a paintbrush or do anything artistic?
Yeah, that almost is so far back I can't really remember. I mean, I think it was just that there was always an environment where that was encouraged. I can't have any sort of idea about growing up in a world as a child where if I'd wanted to paint something, I'd have been told, don't make a mess or, put that down. It was usually just available. My mum is 91 years old and is still painting. She's just finished a commission this week. She's always had a total, a love of painting being part of her day. She still paints pretty well every day, and I guess that's been the sort of role model for just sort of fitting in something like that within your schedule. But it has always been around, so it's almost like walking, really. I can't think about when I first painted. It's so far back.
So hearing about your mother, who's still painting at 91, I can understand where the work ethic and the ability to keep lots of things in your life comes from. So let's explore that aspect a little bit, because as I mentioned, you were lead for the department at quite a troublesome time in the department, and I was deputy lead at the time, and I saw how hard you were working on that aspect of your life. But at the same time, every now and again, you'd show me a picture that you'd done, a picture you'd painted, and I knew that you were building models for Bonfire Night for your village, and you were also, spending time with your family. How do you manage to fit all these things into your life?
I've been thinking about doing this podcast for a few weeks, and I really at no point want to ever sound like I'm saying to people, this is what you should do. I think this is about what you could do, and I know that for some people they can't do these things because their time is so full. And I recognise times historically when the family have been growing up, and I've had more time pressure with work and things where I haven't been able to fit things in, and I've had to let things drop back. But ultimately, with things like the Working Time Directive, there's 168 hours in the week. I think I'm lucky in so many ways, and I again I totally I mean I don't actually sleep very much. I get up pretty early. I'm usually up by about 5 o'clock most mornings. Most of the things I do in a fairly furious and intense way. My paintings, portrait, I'm normally doing within about 4 to 8 hours, something like that. I usually do in 1/2 hour sessions. I usually like a lot of things on the go at the same time. So there's lots of different sort of tactics that you can put in, actually properly giving time over to things, but also just getting really passionate about things, being really committing to something that you want to do, to the point where you want to try and push it as far as you can. I'll raise the jigsaw one because it is something that is outside of the painting thing, is that about 3 years ago, my daughter and I decided that we wanted to start competing in competitive jigsaw puzzle solving. And we started to actually put a lot of time over to training to that. And we got to the point where we probably re reached our high watermark with that. We went to the World Championships in Spain, and we end up being of the 25 British teams. We were the only one that qualified for the final. There's 3,500 people competing across the event there. So we were having to do, leading into that, like a pretty well a jigsaw puzzle a day running into that. we just properly committed to doing that. We probably are going to step back from that a bit more now, and I definitely want to be putting more time into the portrait project, which I'm sure we'll come to, because that has been sort of ticking on a little bit in the background. But now we've achieved what we wanted to achieve with that. That's working out, working out what we want to do, working out a goal, and just pursuing it with passion and a certain amount of dedication. I have had times where I've also was involved with writing medical books. I've written, I think, it's around about eight books, including the two that have been involved with illustrations. And when we were doing that, obviously that's a little bit different because you're involved with publishers' deadlines and things like that. But I usually could find somewhere in the region of sort of 20 hours a week, somewhere where I could apply that to the writing, and sometimes more approaching the deadline. There sometimes would be more hours in. And I think you just have to make life decisions. I've made decisions, and again, this is totally not judgmental about anything about what other people want to do, but I didn't ever go down the path of doing any private practice. It is an interesting one. I quite often, quite often, if you're involved in creative things, you get people say, "Oh, you must have time on your hands." And I was thinking about this point. It does get put to you a little bit as a creative in medicine. And I was thinking, you never get that the same if you're like an elite sports person and a doctor. So I guess you don't.
Do you think there's a value judgment about, the flakiness of being a creative?
Well, I think people look at those as being sort of like hobbies and fun and things like that. Whereas I think a lot of people do sport for fun, but it becomes a little bit more. I think a lot of things that are fun, but sometimes become a little bit more. But I think there is the space to go and do that. I mean, interestingly, I think there's so many transferable skills. I mean, I think you can be almost interested in anything and just pursue it as much as you can, and you'll find that there are transferable skills. And whether that, because it could be anything as broad as the ability to work on your own or the ability to work in a team. So you can start anywhere with this discussion and think about something in anything that you're doing. And by pursuing it and pushing hard with it, you can get transferable skills. And problem solving, thinking creatively, thinking originally, all these sort of things, your own time management. There's so many things about pursuing things that aren't medicine. And I don't know whether this is us just our own individual view of how we feel we should be seen as doctors. I think a lot of people have that, where they sort of think, I should be seen as being I might be seen as not being dedicated. I mean, that's an interesting discussion, isn't it? It's about I might be seen as not being dedicated. And I am 100% dedicated to being a doctor when I'm being a doctor. And whether that's actually administering clinical medicine or learning about stuff that I need to learn to keep me up to date or whatever it is, I'm totally dedicated to that. But also I recognize that for me, probably to actually be a better doctor, it helps me to have a broad range of things that I'm interested in.
So I'm getting the impression that you are able to compartmentalize things quite well.
I think the things that give me the most joy are the sort of things I can get into, like that flow state with. And so, I mean, I love swimming, and I love the painting, and they are probably the two things. I mean, again, if the jigsaw's going well along with the jigsaw, they're the two things that when I'm really in doing those with the painting, the building could be burning down around me, and I would just be noticing that the paint's drying a bit quicker. I mean, that might be just about it, but I do compartmentalize where my sort of brain is focused. I think that's good also for your sort of psychological well-being. I don't carry a lot of baggage around from working in medicine, and I'm almost all my stuff is actually trauma-based. So we see a reasonable amount of what probably if I was to show to my non-medical members of my family, or if they were to experience what we experience on a daily basis, would think would be pretty grim. I think that helps me sort of almost like wash my brain, really, I suppose.
I was going to say, it's a sort of mental hygiene, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the other thing, apart from compartmentalizing, that I think I see in you is an ability to use every moment of the day. I mean, I'm imagining you don't spend much time just sitting staring into space.
Yeah, no, it's lunchtime now, and I've already done a painting and been for a swim. And done some social media stuff for the project. So, and
Perfect.
replied to an email from El Salvador. So
Excellent, excellent. So we mentioned, or you mentioned briefly about the medical illustration, and I know that you haven't done that as a sort of formal qualification or anything, but you have done some illustrating in the books that you've been involved in writing. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that came about a little bit by chance. We were having I've been writing a lot of books for helping with the new exam formats from when the exam first changed from the old three-part system in '96, and then when it and then when the SAQs and then the SBAs came in. Basically, wrote a number of exam books, and we were having a publishing party with the three authors in relation to one of those books being published. And one of the other authors had just had previously, we'd helped him getting a book deal to do an anatomy book. And unfortunately, the person he was going to get to do his illustrations fell through, and his project was pretty well dead in the water. It was because he didn't have an illustrator. And this book was going to have around, I think it was about 120, 140 illustrations. And the price of actually getting a professional medical illustrator to do it compared to the selling market for the total number of anaesthetists who might buy the book meant that it was a project that could not have a professional medical illustrator do it on a fee basis. So it had to be done on a voluntary basis. And at that dinner, I was sort of a little bit flattered, and there's the you do a little bit of painting, James, don't you? Would you be interested in doing some medical illustrations? And I said, oh, okay, well, I'll do a couple and see what you like. And not surprisingly, when I showed them a couple of illustrations, they said, oh, these are great. Yes, would you like to do the book? And I didn't actually realize at that stage what quite a big undertaking that was, because medical illustrations is often a very iterative process. And so 120 illustrations, I mean, typically, I think we probably went through four or five iterations per image. So you're doing about 500 illustrations to do 120 illustrations. And I was living next to a graphic designer at the time, and he said to me, I'd said, oh, this is interesting, I'm going to be doing this. He said, how are you going to do it? And I said, well, I was going to just paint them. He said, you are insane, because you'll make mistakes or they'll change. And you're doing 500 painted illustrations. So at that point, I had to learn how to use to make digital art. So the medical illustrations part has been a different thing for me, in that it was learning digital art. And then we went on and did the graphic anesthesia book, which was then learning more like graphic design art. So that's much more in terms of line vector path drawing and lines. So there's quite a bit of sort of uploading the next program for a new skill. But then that's lovely. I love that idea about buying some of the illustrating projects products and learning how to use them. Yeah, so that was how that all came about. Once we'd done the second book, I'd had enough of doing the digital stuff and the illustrations. We got them done, and I'm not sure I'd want to take on that sort of project again, because those were vast and those took a huge amount of time. That was probably the most time commitment I ever had in any of the writing thing. And some of that was d deeply frustrating as well. You're just trying to get things right. I remember there was one drawing for doing an axillary block for the anatomy for that, and because of the nature of the way you have the anatomy for an axillary block with the arm up and out, it's not visible on any scans or anything, so you can't go to any of the sort of CT scans or anything, or look at classic anatomy books, because you're not in the anatomical position. So we went through, I think, 10 or 11 iterations to try and get that right. And Andy kept on writing back to me saying, it's not quite right, James. Yeah. Anyway, but I did learn things from that have helped me going back to non-digital art, traditional art. I learned a lot about color theory, which was terrific. and how to manipulate color. And I think I was pretty good at color before that, but I've got improved knowledge having spent 6 years doing digital art, doing medical illustrations.
Yeah, that's interesting actually to hear that you learned to, a lot of new stuff. It wasn't necessarily going to be something that you're going to stick with forever, but you took a lot of lessons from it. And that kind of brings us on to your painting. And some of the first things you showed me were your wildlife paintings. Did you do a picture of your mother's dogs? Was that, am I remembering?
No, I did do some. I have done. I've done. So I did end up doing quite a lot of dog paintings, because as you alluded to, I was specialty lead at North Bristol, and as I was coming sort of towards the end of that, the tenure for that, I started to pick up the painting a little bit more, and I also changed medium. I'd previously always been painting in what I call pasty acrylic paints, the sort of stuff that you see in a classic paint tube, which you squeeze out onto a palette and it looks like sort of paste, and you mix it up and move it around. To in 2018, I started to use ink, and was very much just doing that for a bit of fun, but started to build up a commission base for that. I previously had been doing some commercial art from about 2005 onwards, with selling pieces. It's about 2005 was a watershed really, from when I went from probably being a hobby artist to more of a commercial artist and actually sort of selling work. So when I got back into it, it wasn't long before I was selling. Into the winter of 2018, I was seeing what people wanted to paint, and one of the things that a lot of people want you to paint is dogs and pet portraits. So I was running into then doing quite a lot of pet portraits. So I painted a lot of dogs. Interesting, because I mean, we'll come on to doing the human portraits. I quite often found that the clients were more fussy about likeness with their pet portraits than they have ever been with the human portraits.
I can well imagine. So yes, let's come on to the human portraits. So tell us a bit about how that evolved from your pet and wildlife work.
Yeah, so I carried on painting through to around about, would that be February 2020, when something seemed to happen, and I was enjoying the pet portrait stuff. Getting a bit fed up of just painting dogs, but I was sort of I was like I was liking it. Both you and I will remember that time that we were very busy with trying to turn the hospital into whatever it might need to be, working a lot of hours, and I had probably one of the longest stints where I didn't paint. Because we were putting so many hours in trying to get things moved around, I got to the summer of 2020 and decided I wanted to paint something different. And I think I tried to work this out. I think prior to the summer of 2020, I think I'd only ever done three portraits prior to that. And I had the idea about trying to do something different and difficult in my mind, and subsequently, it's interesting because I have been talking to some people about that. They said, "Did I have had one or two people ask me, and I'm wondering whether this is true, is whether because we'd been having the time of wearing masks for such a long amount of time, whether I'd actually miss seeing people's faces, and whether the business for portrait painting was driven by the desire to actually sort of really stare at people's faces."
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thought, isn't
I'd
it?
always been really frightened of doing portraits beforehand, because there's something about the sort of structural bit of features that is, actually to try and give that impression by putting areas of color and light and dark down. I thought it also sounded a little bit difficult to me, but I thought I'd give it a go. And then I was scratching around for a healthy adult volunteer to have their portrait done, and a certain Dr. Fiona Donald agreed to send me a photo. So thank you very much, Fiona. You're very much at the start of this path. And I did pretty well my first ink portrait of you. And as I was painting it, and when I finished it, I remember thinking, I think I've got something like a likeness there. And I found that really lovely. I really enjoyed that business about getting the likeness on paper of a fellow human being. And then there was a few other things also. I was quite keen to paint portraits with people showing sort of nice emotional states, And I asked a lot of people in the department and other friends and things to send me pictures. And I just was doing a lot of portraits at that time. I was doing three or four a week, with smiles, frowns, grimaces, real sort of happy faces, open mouths. I like painting open mouths. A lot of portrait artists don't like that. But again, someone again was talking to me about that, about whether that's just from 30 odd years of staring in people's mouths. I'm fairly happy about what the insides of people's mouths look like. So I was painting that. And again, interestingly, commission work started to pick up with that. So I was doing some commission work as well, and did about 6 months of portrait painting. And because of my slightly nuts, grandiose way of thinking, I thought, well, clearly I could go on the Sky Portrait Artist of the Year program and win that. Or at least enter it and have a bit of fun. And I put in an entry for that. And whilst, like a lot of medics, when you recognize that you're going to have an assessment process, I recognize that for that competition, you're required to paint a portrait in 4 hours. So I started to again ask around, get lots of people to send me images, and started to do portraits in 4 hours. For the 7 weeks from when I applied at the beginning of January 2021 through to when I heard 7 weeks later that I hadn't got on the program. And I think I did 35 portraits in 7 weeks. So that's pretty good going. And whilst I was doing that, around the time that I didn't get on the program, I'd been quite keen to paint all different sorts of ethnic groups, age groups, hair colors, textures. I hadn't done anybody with long black hair, long curvy black hair, which is one of the hardest things for me in ink to do. And I knew a Mexican artist called Paulina Nino, and I asked Paulina whether I could paint her picture. And I was painting her picture, really enjoyed the business of painting the hair and painting the picture, but also was communicating with her whilst I was painting it, and we were having a bit of a chat about where she was in Mexico. And I love painting somebody who's in a different part of the world. And I went to bed on that Saturday night, at the end of February 2021, thinking, that was really nice. I'd probably like to paint some people from other countries. That's been a lot of fun. And woke up on the Sunday morning, again at 5 o'clock in the morning. And there's actually a video online on the YouTube channel of this,
I see.
of me sort of talking to the camera and actually having the moment where I woken up and I said, I've gone to bed thinking I'd like to paint some other countries, but I think I'd actually like to paint a portrait of people from every country. And that was basically the birth of this thing called the Global Portrait Project, which I've been working on ever since, which is a project to paint 193 portraits of 193 people, each from a different country, from the United Nations Sovereign States list, going alphabetically. On that Sunday, I didn't have a theme, but by the Monday, the theme fell into place really organically. And that was to look for people involved in their countries in positive environmental action, and then to tell their stories. So I paint the portraits, I film the portraits, I blog about this on social media, and I post the time lapse videos onto the Global Portrait Project YouTube channel with the people's stories told over that. So again, that is actually also not just the painting. There's another whole set of skills acquisition to go through there, because I'd never done any video editing, sorting out, the studio and lighting and script writing. And again, a whole different sort of, different level of social media management, website design, lots of things. And then there's also other challenges there as well, which is things like actually finding the people to paint, and finding the stories. Because if you're going alphabetically, you immediately start with Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria. I, in April of 2021, did not know anybody in any of those countries. And so having to actually go and find the people, find the stories. But it has since then just been such a wonderful journey, and so entertaining, and such a happy thing for me to be involved with, because I have a fascinating email inbox. Because I get, as I said, messages this morning when I woke up from El Salvador, I've literally just this week found somebody from Egypt as well. So I've got those two that I've been trying to find somebody from. And I'm still pretty well in all. I mean, I've now on to, so what have we just done? I've just done Ecuador, which is country 52. We had an exhibition, well, I had an exhibition of the first 50 portraits back in beginning of February. And leading into that, I wrote to everybody who I have painted for the project, and I got in contact with 47 of them. So I'm still regularly in contact with a lot of them, and they're all following the project on social media. So it's just this lovely feeling of this sort of wonderful engaged group of people from all around the world. And that was, I think, something that was very popular with the exhibition. I think that there was a lot of impact from that when people were in the room looking at all the portraits of the faces, looking down with sort of different levels of expressions, of some looking sort of confident, some looking sort of happy, some looking serious, but just seeing all these faces of people involved from different countries in sort of in positive stuff in their countries. It was nice. It felt the opposite of cynical, whatever that might be.
I definitely agree. So I came along to the exhibition to see it, which is partly how I came to think about the fact that it would be good to talk to you in this podcast. And I think that a couple of things I took away. So the message that everybody can do something about climate change and environmental change. And if we all do something, then that adds up to quite a lot of stuff being done. And having looked at some of the videos that you've made, I would really encourage people to go and look at those because they really do, whatever you're doing, they lift your mood, because it's just great to see those positive actions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a to give a little flavour of the stories. There's everything from sort of people doing local level upcycling, whether that's Marissa from Andorra who's turning vinyl banners into laptop bags, or Atak from Armenia who's turning rifle shells into jewellery, through to Andrea from Costa Rica who's been sort of shaping her national and international policy for. Against deforestation for 20 years, and has changed, helped to change Costa Rica from being heavily deforested 20 years ago to really being quite a sort of special place. I think a lot of people now seem to be visiting because it's really has recovered splendidly.
I mean, and that's, as I say, that's certainly the message that I took away from it. So at that stage, you'd done 50 and you're now 52. Is it speeding up as you go along, slowing down, or does it have a sort of variable pace depending on what's happening with sourcing people to paint?
One of the most common questions I get asked is when will it finish? And I'm sort of slightly not addressing that question because it has slowed down quite a bit. I am trying to enjoy all of it as a journey. I do recognise that I probably need to get the pace up again, but I have got various things in place that will help to do that. So, reducing the amount of jigsaw time is definitely going to help, which is very much in the schedule. That we feel now we've reached our high water mark for that. So that will be parked a bit now, and I've also got a group of people now helping me to find people because the thing that does slow the project up is not having a run of people ahead of me to paint. So ideally, and I mean again, I would blatantly take the opportunity of being on the podcast now that anybody who knows anybody in any countries who they'd like to put me in contact with from the alphabet from Ecuador onwards, well, let's say from El Salvador onwards, there's lots of different ways of contacting me. They don't even have to be environmentalists. They can literally just be people in countries I can start conversations with. Because actually having people lined up, like at the moment, I'm slightly treading water because I finished Ecuador 10 days ago, and I'm probably not going to be able to start Egypt until I'm planning photos should come through beginning of this week, and then I'll be able to get on with that. So trying to avoid downtime will really help. I am planning on trying to put my foot down a little bit and go a bit faster, but not to the point where I lose the enjoyment of being sort of in the project. I think that's important. If it just became a sort of a factory process, then I think it would be it wouldn't be what I wanted to be doing.
Going back a little bit in our conversation, you mentioned that the one of the first portraits you did was of me, and I'd just like to say that I absolutely love that portrait. It was a picture of me laughing uproariously, which I always think is a nice place to be. I can see an evolution from that portrait, and then I can definitely see an evolution even from the first one you did. I mean, I'm presuming that over the course of 50 or more portraits, you do develop your art.
Yeah, I think they have changed a little bit, but I do also think that if you look at them, they look like they're done by the same artist, and they have a style to them. When I first started, I was coming out of the portrait in 4 hour mindset, and so I think they are a little bit more raw and a bit quicker. There's something about that I really like. But now I quite like just spending as much time really as I feel I need to take. I tend to paint. I have like a real intense painting energy that lasts for about half an hour. It's about half an hour to 40 minutes, and so I paint in half an hour to 40 minute blocks, and typically I will do about 15 to 20 of those to finish a portrait. So I think now I'm probably am more like spending 8 to 10 hours. So I'm probably doubling the amount of time I was spending on the portraits. And I think that they probably are a little bit more finessed, a little bit more detailed, a little bit more photorealistic. I may well feel that they've lost a little bit of the spontaneity to them with that, but my aim isn't to get absolute photorealism. I mean, working in ink's never really like that because ink is quite a difficult medium to master. It can just choose to go where it wants to go. If you get it in the wrong place, there's not much you can do about it. So it's not most portrait artists paint in oil because it's much more iterative and you can push oil around until you're happy. But ink, you can't really go dark to light, and once it's down, it's down. So it's a sort of different. It's a different process for me for painting to lightness in ink.
More akin to watercolour, really.
Yeah, but I mean, even watercolor is more movable.
Right.
My mum works in watercolor, and so I've seen her over the years pushing watercolor around a little bit more. But ink is. It's pretty brutal.
I wanted to talk about your technique a bit as well, because I was talking to you about this at the exhibition. So you use a grid and you draw in quite a lot of detail, don't you?
Yeah. So my grid drawing takes me about an hour, and to get lightness in ink, you would have to be either a considerably better artist than me, which I totally would get that. Some people are, or you have to do what I do, which is to get a fairly accurate outline sketch down to work into. But again, it's a bit like we talked about a lot of things, and going back to anesthetics, it's a bit like that sort of planning thing. How you go about your process, how you go about your planning, and thinking about what the next bit of paint's going to be.
The other aspect of the Global Portrait Project, which you've touched on, is that if there is an organisation that the person is connected to, you will kind of advertise that through the project, through the website. Do you have any idea of any impact that has arisen as a result of these people being involved in the Global Portrait Project?
I don't know at this stage. I don't know. I haven't had anybody write back to me and say we've seen a leap in our subscriber numbers or anything like that. Because I think from my point of view, the project is still fairly small scale and still in an expanding stage. I do know that pretty well everybody's enjoyed it. And I would hope that as time passes on, that they will get some actual benefit beyond that.
And I know you haven't met face to face many of the people that you've painted, but one of your subjects did come to the exhibition, didn't she?
Yes, so that was quite a moment. I mean, the exhibition was in a very small venue, and that was a bit deliberate because it was to do a little bit of a test of what an exhibition for the project would look like. And as part of the week in there, I agreed to do a talk one evening, and I out of courtesy wrote to everybody I wrote to everybody to sort of say the exhibition's on, everybody I'd painted that the exhibition was on. And Crystal Ambrose, who's an anti-plastics campaigner from the Bahamas, wrote back to me and said, "Oh, that's amazing. I've been planning coming to the UK. I've booked my flight. I'll be coming." I think I've bought my tickets to the talk. I think I'd sold 8 tickets at that point. I thought, well, including somebody coming from the Bahamas. But what was lovely is, I mean, Crystal was one of only 3 people who won the Goldman Environmental Prize, which is like the big international, the sort of biggest international prize you can get in environmentalism. And within the talk I gave, I talked a little bit about the sort of timeline of the project and then interspersed that with people's stories. And we didn't let anybody know that Crystal was in the audience until we got to talking about her section. And then I got everybody to stand up after I'd told Crystal's story. And I said, "Now sit down if you've not won a Goldman Environmental Prize." And then only Crystal was left standing. And I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Crystal Ambrose." And that was just a lovely little moment. And then we really had a terrific evening.
Oh,
And
fantastic.
Crystal was an absolute joy to meet. Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been quite something. Think we're probably coming to the end of our talk now, and I'd really like to thank you for taking the time to come and talk to me. I thought I knew you quite well before this. I think I probably did, but I know quite a lot more about you now, and I understand a bit more about how you're doing what you're doing, and I'll have to try and take a few of those lessons away. The ones about not sitting staring into space would be helpful, I think.
I think sitting staring into space is fine. I do sometimes genuinely do that.
I know, yeah. Perhaps one's brain needs a little bit of sort of downtime every now and again. Is there anything that you'd like to add at this point, James? Any sort of final words for the people who are listening to this podcast?
Well, I'm always happy, as I said, for to get people to get in contact. Very happy for people to come and have a look at the project. And the whole project is, it's a not for profit. It's nothing is for sale. It's I'm a one man band doing it, and anything from the project is available under Creative Commons if people want to share it. It is about getting these pe wonderful people's stories out there. So please come and have a look and get in contact if you'd like to.
I'm sure there will be a few people who will get in contact. And I think also people will, anaesthetists who are listening to this will take away the fact that there are always transferable skills, and that actually taking your brain and indeed your physicality into another space can help when you come back to your day job.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the idea of thinking big. I mean, we had this we some of the writing projects and the is just if think as big as you can and then just go for it if you can. It's not for everybody.
Absolutely. And but equally, as we said in the ethos of this project, everybody can do something, and if everybody does do something, no matter what it is, then those somethings add up, don't they? And bigger something. So yeah, but I agree, thinking big is a positive thing, and I've definitely seen you do that over the years. So I'd like to thank everyone who's been listening to this podcast. We'll have more information and useful links in the episode description. For more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anaesthesia on Air and review the podcast list while you're there. Okay, thanks very much. Bye bye.